The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tastytrade Inc. is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
This is Charlie's mic, and this is Warren's mic,
This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today, we are revisiting A Wealth of Wisdom, our four-part 2021 series with Warren Buffett.
Hi!
Becky Quick sits down with the Oracle of Omaha, 91 years young, and still building a $100 billion fortune.
But we did start with three failures.
And his longtime partner and prophet, Charlie Munger.
I just know instantly Charlie was the kind of guy that I was going to like him and I was going to learn from.
How they met, how they do business, what's changed, and what hasn't in their 60 years of friendship.
What I like about Warren is the irreverence. We don't have automatic reverence for the pompous heads of all civilization.
Treat Warren like you'd treat any 90-year-old. I was 35 at the time. And it worked very well. We had a good relationship.
Plus the wisdom in Buffett's wealth.
I've never borrowed a dollar. I wasn't sure I was going to pay back one way or another.
And Becky Quick reflects on covering the Berkshire billionaire.
And he was telling stories just about some of the deals he and Charlie had done and different things. And I thought, wow, you know, you're better off if you just shut up and listen to them.
Squawk Pod begins right after this.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
This is Squawk Pod from CNBC. Today and for the rest of this week, we're bringing you an unscripted, intimate conversation with our Becky Quick and about 190 years of business wisdom, Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. The two Nebraska natives have been friends for more than six decades and business partners for more than five. Since the late 1960s, they have been CEO and vice chair of one of the country's biggest companies. Berkshire Hathaway is worth some $600+ billion. Here they are at one of the famous Berkshire Hathaway annual meetings for shareholders, part trade show.
Hi!
Can you get a picture?
Absolutely.
Part convention.
If you'll just hold your applause until the end or even later if you wish.
Part Lollapalooza.
I'm Warren. This is Charlie. He can hear, I can see, we work together.
Buffett is the Oracle of Omaha, perhaps America's most famous investor. He has amassed a more than $100 billion fortune running the conglomerate that oversees dozens of household names, Geico, Fruit of the Loom, Dairy Queen, and acquiring stocks. Buffett's portfolio is about $300 billion in shares of companies like Apple, Bank of America, and Coca-Cola. Munger is vice chair, a lawyer by training, and an investor by practice. Here he is in 2016 about their partnership.
I constantly quote Warren, and everybody always loves it. You take the high road, it's uncrowded.
Let's kick this off with our Becky Quick.
How did you start covering Warren Buffett?
Well, it was, a little bit by accident. I'd met him a couple of times. I'd been out to the annual meeting and gotten a chance to say hi and ask a couple of questions of him. He used to do this thing where he'd do 5 minutes with any broadcast reporter who showed up, and he'd just line up all of them, and you'd stand on a line, you get 5 minutes, he'd just work his way down the line. So I met him that way. I'd heard he was going to China. I had just gone to China with Boone Pickens, and I thought, wow, let me just call him up. So I called him up, we chatted a little bit, and I said, hey, I hear you're going to China. Can I go with you? Which, by the way, was such a weird, bizarre thing, totally out of character for me. And he's so nice and Midwestern and polite. He paused for a long moment, and I guess he couldn't figure out a polite way to say no. So he said, well, okay, sure. But that I remember hanging up the phone after he said yes and being like, oh, that's going to be so great. And then I thought, oh my gosh, what in the heck am I going to talk to Warren Buffett about for 12 hours on this flight over there? When I showed up, he was getting on the plane. He had a stack of newspapers and all of these quarterly reports he was bringing to read. And we just started talking newspapers because he shared his newspapers with me. He was just very interested in the process and the journalism in it. We talked a lot about those things and we kind of hit it off.
Didn't get the first one about insurance.
China Life, did you look at buying?
Oh, no, there was a rumor.
And that was kind of the beginning of it all. And it was just really interesting to see what was happening in China at that point, the things they were involved with.
All right, Warren, I guess we've only been here, what would you say, about 6 hours?
Something like that, yeah, maybe a little less even.
All right, so it's early initial first impressions, but what do you think?
It blows me away. I mean, we've been driving, I don't know how many miles, and it's just one plant, one new plant after another, and every name in the world. I've never seen so much industrial activity, and particularly that's been developed that recently in a place like this.
What year was that when you invited yourself to China?
I think it was 2007, maybe, when I went with Warren.
All right, Warren, we're on our way back.
Okay.
Trip's over. You know, you mentioned this was a two-day world tour. Why are your trips so short?
Well, there's not much I can do after. I can cut a ribbon. You know, I'm pretty good at that now. I've had a lot of practice. And I can smile. But in terms of telling them how to lay out a factory or telling them in terms of how to make sales calls or develop new ideas from R&D, I'm pretty useless. So I do what I can do and what's needed, and then I get back home.
Great. Excellent. Jerry, you just want to get a river?
I pick up the phone from the office anyway at the house, so I'll just start reading like crazy.
Yeah, a lot of catching up to do. Those big boxes never got completely
read. The big boxes, just, they were for show. I just wanted to show you what I would have done if you hadn't been walking.
He's somebody who, you know, is just constantly thinking. It's what he does so well. Charlie does it too, you know. These guys can look at something, hear a problem, look at something, look at a deal, look at a potential valuation of a business, and they've analyzed it 7 ways to Sunday before they even open their mouths. You're better off if you just shut up and listen to them. Their depth of knowledge and their recall on everything. I think they both have photographic memories. They can read anything and remember it, like the details of deals from 50 years ago. And that's what started this whole thing. Warren and I had been talking back and forth, getting ready for the Berkshire annual meeting, where I was just trying to figure out what we were doing because he was going out to Los Angeles, whether I was going to be able to go out. And he was telling stories just about some of the deals he and Charlie had done and different things. And I thought, wow, you know, the two of them are going to be together in Los Angeles. It'd be great to get them to sit down and talk about some of these things.
This is Warren's mic. Warren's mic.
Morning, Warren. How are you?
Becky sat down with longtime friends Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger earlier this spring.
Charlie, you have a beautiful home.
Well, I built it in 1959. I've never moved.
You're looking at two billionaires that have lived in the same house for 62 years. I don't know how many of there are.
These two have personalities that work together so well. And you talked to them about the way they first met, which was in the late 1950s. And it's sort of struck me as like, it's a bit like a cinematic romance or a bromance, I guess, right? But they were set up. It's really cute, isn't it?
It is. You know, there was someone who had invested with Warren.
Thank you. You two have been friends for how long? Why don't you guys talk about how you first met?
And he invested a lot of money at the time with Warren when he was starting his own fund. You know, Warren was in his 20s, in his late 20s.
Well, want to tell the story?
Go ahead.
There was a doctor couple, very prominent in Omaha, and his name was Eddie Davis, her name was Dorothy Davis. She was very, very smart. He was very famous as a doctor, and they called me one day, and they said, and I had met him, and it was Mrs. Davis that called me naturally. She did everything. And she said, we've heard that you manage money, and we'd be kind of interested in listening to your story about how you do it and what we might do with you. So I went over, and I talked to him, and I was all full of myself, and I couldn't talk fast enough about stocks in those days. and Dorothy Davis, very smart, and she listened to every word. I mean, she sat there like you right across, and she was taking it on, and she'd ask good questions and everything. And the doctor was kind of over in the corner spinning a yo-yo or something, and would not pay much attention. And I got all through, and the wife looked over at the doctor, and he said, I'm going to give him $100,000. And I was managing about $500,000 at the time, so it was a big deal. And in a very nice way, I said, Dr. Davis, I said, you know, you really haven't been paying much attention to what I've been saying and everything. I'd kind of like to know why you're giving me this $100,000. It was much more modest than that, the way I edged into it. And Dr. Davis looked at me and he said, well, he says you remind me of Charlie Munger. And I said, well, I don't know who Charlie Munger is, but I like him. And he gave me $100,000. And then they told me about Charlie, and they clearly loved him. And it sort of became their mission that sometime they wanted to get me and Charlie together. One time, Dr. Davis was adding to the sum he was put into the partnership, and he started making out the checks to Charlie. I said, Eddie, I knew him better. But I said, Eddie, you know, it's one thing to confuse me with the guy, but when you start writing the checks, get my name in there, you know. So Charlie, in 1959, his dad died, and he came back to Alma. His mother lived there, and she was a terrific woman, Tootie Munger, and everybody in town knew Tootie. And the Davises really got us together. I don't know whether it was Neil, was it the son actually that arranged the dinner, Charlie, or that,
it wasn't Neil. It was the daughter, I think, Will, and her.
Will, yeah. And so they arranged the dinner, and there's two different members of where we went, but we went to this dinner, and about 5 minutes into it, Charlie was sort of rolling on the floor laughing at his own jokes, which is exactly the same thing I did. So I'm not going to find another guy like this. And we just hit it off.
Charlie, what did they first tell you about Warren? How did they describe him to you?
Well, the Davises were like a second set of parents to me. There were two sets of three children. My father's best friend was Eddie Davis. My mother's best friend was Mrs. Davis. I lived in that house back and forth as though it were an alternate house of the Mungers. And Mrs. Davis gave me the honor of switching my legs when I misbehaved, just as if I were one of her own.
You probably gave her plenty of calls,
so
too.
Anything the Davises asked me to do, I was going to do. And Dr. Davis was the son of the main mathematics professor at the University of Nebraska. And he was a very brilliant man and very lean and skillful and mechanically gifted, with good quality and a surgeon, by the way. And I just had endless respect for the Davises. So anything they suggested, I would automatically do.
What did you think of Warren when you first met him?
We got along fine.
Oh, well. Both of our wives thought, my God, another one.
Buffett and Munger became friends, kindred spirits, but found they had shared values and sort of a shared personality that could create an entirely new kind of business.
You know, it was a case of like at first sight, I guess you could say. The two of them really hit it off and started laughing at their own jokes together. And that was that.
What I like about Warren is the irreverence. We don't have automatic reverence for the pompous heads of all civilization.
Is that something that came with age, or
we were born that way?
We were kind of always the way. We were a little more extreme. I've learned to behave a little bit better. Charlie really hadn't learned to be much better. But we, you know, I just knew instantly Charlie was the kind of guy that I was going to like him and I was going to learn from. But it wasn't anything calculated decision or anything like that. It was natural. And we have had nothing but fun.
We came from good people. If there's any failure, it wasn't our people.
It's striking that they're both over 90 and still not only working full-time and fully engaged, but also sort of acting as like Rosetta Stones for successful business. How have they structured Berkshire, kind of in their own likeness, but how have they structured it that's so different and unusual from other companies?
It's just very loosely structured. I mean, they buy companies and then they literally leave them alone. They buy companies where they like the managers and they want managers that want to stay with the business. They get excited about other people who are like them, who love their jobs and love working. So I think for them, neither one of them ever wanted a boss. Even, you know, Warren Buffett, going back, he's only had three bosses in his life. He was telling me at one point. One of them was the guy at JCPenney when he was a kid. Another one was the guy when he had Paper Route, who ran all the paper routes. And the third one was Ben Graham, who Warren idolized.
Benjamin Graham, the father of value investing. He wrote The Intelligent Investor back in 1949. It's a business and investing book that is still widely read today. Although, naturally, Warren Buffett read it back then. A couple of years later, he studied under Graham at Columbia Business School. Graham's philosophy was making money without taking on too much risk. Sound familiar? Those ideas shaped Warren Buffett into the investor he's been for the last 70 years. And Graham was heading up a company called Geico while he was teaching at Columbia. Now, this is long before the Spokes Gecko and the insurance company being a wholly owned subsidiary of Berkshire Hathaway.
I mean, I stumbled into the insurance business because Ben Graham, I was at the library at Columbia, and I looked up my hero, Ben Graham, whose course I was taking there, and it said, Chairman, Government Employees Insurance Company. I didn't know what Government Employees Insurance Company was. So I went to the librarian and I said, where can I learn more about insurance companies? He said, well, you get this big blue book over here and it tells about them. So there was a page in 2,000 pages, and it said they were in Washington, D.C. And I didn't know a thing about it. And that Saturday, I got on the first train to get down there and went down to visit this company that my hero was chairman of. Although he was teaching at Columbia one course a week and all that, he was based in New York. And when I got to the place, the door was locked. And in Omaha, they worked on Saturday, but in Washington, they didn't work on Saturday. And the door's locked. I started pounding on the door. And finally, a janitor came and he let me in. And I said, is there anybody here but you? And he didn't seem to take offense to that. And he said, there's a guy up on the top floor. And there's a wonderful man named Lorimer Davidson. And he spent about 4 hours. And he'd gone down there on Saturday to do something else. And I ruined his day. But he gave me a lifetime education in insurance in 4 hours. He's just a super wonderful man. And I did not get interested in insurance because of the float. I got interested because of Geico and really the underwriting and the growth possibility. So my interest in the insurance business started when I was in school, as the first stock it wasn't really the first stock I bought at all, but it was the first stock I bought sort of post-Graham. And I had 3/4 of my net worth in that stock. And it was the first stock I sold when I became a stock salesman. At age 20, I left Columbia and went back to Omaha and started selling stocks, and I just went all over town telling people they were idiots that they didn't buy stock in Geico. And when I get all through, they'd always say, well, what does your dad think? And that made me mad. So I was one of them.
Coming up on Squawk Pod.
As the ink dried, we realized we'd made a big mistake.
Learning from your mistakes. Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, and the value of an undervalued business.
All the early businesses that we owned together have disappeared.
They didn't disappear, they failed.
They failed, yeah.
Yeah, right.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information.
FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
CNBC has quick and easy to understand business news updates at the open, midday, and close every weekday. Markets, money, and more from Wall Street to Main Street. I'm CNBC's Jessica Ettinger. Follow and listen to CNBC Business News Updates wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. The Berkshire Bromance. A few years after meeting Charlie Munger in Omaha, Warren Buffett had grown his investment partnership into more than $250,000. He found Berkshire Hathaway, started buying stock in the textile mill in 1962, and took ownership of it in 1965. A few years ago, a film reel was discovered in the Nebraska State Archives from a local television crew's 1962 interview with young Omaha investor Warren Buffett.
I think the president's action on steel probably had something to do with the timing of the decline, but I don't.
He was weighing in on the policies of President Kennedy, and 31-year-old Buffett totally looks the part. Skinny tie, close-cropped hair, black frame glasses. He was asked to comment, like he would be today, on the markets.
Well, in a nutshell, Mr. Buffett, can you give us your opinion of just exactly what happened, what caused it?
Well, there was undoubtedly some forced selling the week when the stock market hit the news. The previous week, prices had declined about 6% for the week on average. And there was some stock that was forced upon the market both by margin calls from brokers and some that was forced out by improperly secured bank loans.
Around the same time, Munger had given up his career as a lawyer and had been running his own investment firm in Los Angeles. That is, until his good friend convinced him to shutter it and join him at Berkshire.
So how did the business relationship start?
Well, Warren had scorn for my way of making a living, and he was correct in that. It took me a long time to wise up that he had had a better way of making a living than I did. But he finally convinced me that I was wasting my time.
As a lawyer?
Yeah.
I told him it was okay as a hobby, but not the real way to spend his time. He more or less decided to duplicate in Los Angeles what I was doing in Omaha, which was great. You know, and but we, well before that, I mean, we just connected. And we talked a long time on the phone when it was expensive to talk on the phone. I didn't sit there with an hourglass. But with Charlie, I mean, my family could tell when Charlie was calling. I mean, and we'd go on for a long, long time.
And we had fun in the early days because it was like hunting expeditions. We had a lot of fun.
Looking for stocks?
We still have a lot of fun.
Well, and buying things together.
Now we went on one deal to Baltimore and we needed to get a lawyer for it, and the deal was 1966. And we got a guy from Washington that came up, and Charlie's instructions to the lawyer was just, you know, we'll do it our way, but you're just kind of window dressing here, but we need you, and treat Warren like you'd treat any 90-year-old. I was 35 at the time, and it worked very well. We had a good relationship.
Yes.
We have really never had anything, including failures, that weren't fun. You know, they were interesting. I mean, we were working on things together, and we knew we would do well too. I mean, we were self-confident about the world in which we existed then. It was more fun doing it together. I would not want to sit in a room all by myself, spend the rest of my life buying stocks.
One of the first deals they did together was diversified retail. And they'll talk about this department store that they bought together in Baltimore. And it was the two of them and Sandy Gottesman. And they were thrilled at the prospect of it. But as soon as they got into the deal, they realized that it was a melting ice cube.
Baltimore, 1966. Buffett and Munger are working with Sandy Gottesman, who founded First Manhattan Company in the early 60s and was an early Berkshire investor. He's held on to those shares, and they're worth billions today. And the melting ice cube the three had on their hands was the changing behavior of consumers, leaving urban department stores for the mall.
All the early businesses that we owned together have disappeared.
They didn't disappear, they failed.
They failed, yeah.
Right.
But we took so much out of them before they failed that it still worked out fine for us.
Well, and we went on to we evolved them. I mean, but literally, the three base businesses all ended up disappearing. They went out of business. They no longer fit into society, in a sense. And actually, the very first deal that we joined in on was something called Diversified Retailing, which was in Baltimore. We bought a department store there. And we had Sandy Gottesman had 10%, Charlie had 10%, and in his partnership, he had 10%. And I had 80% in our partnership, and the three of us. And we always treated it as, you know, we may have had 80, but we were equal partners. And we put $6 million into that. We called it Diversified Retailing, but we only had one department store chain, but we had, you know. And we had a lot of fun with that, but we also saw after we were in a little while, this department store.
As the ink dried, we realized we'd made a big mistake.
As the ink dried?
Yeah. As the ink dried. It didn't take very long.
Yeah. Why? What happened?
Well, you heard the old story. Let me out of this trap. I decided I don't like the cheese. We just wised up the fact that it was one tough business we'd bought into and that the sellers had made the good decision. We'd made a bad one.
It was at Howard and Lexington Street in Baltimore, which was the busiest corner. Had all four department stores there, Hutzler's, Stewart's, Hochul Cone, that's our store, and Hecht. And none of those four stores are there anymore. And that was number one in traffic count. And you go to Howard and Lexington Street, and there's nothing there now. So, you know, the streetcar tracks may have gone there at one time, but the streetcar tracks aren't important anymore. So we made a mistake. We had some terrific people who were running it for us that were actually related to Sandy's wife.
Exceptionally honorable people.
Really honorable people and smart. If you're losing money in a business with a smart, decent person, you know, we got a problem. I mean, that's the business. Use the smart, decent person to move them over some other place and move the capital some other place.
The company was not yet losing money, but we soon realized it was about to lose money.
Yeah. And so we sold the department store. It went out of business in 1983, but Hutzler's, which was the silk stocking department store, they went out of business in, I don't know, 1985 or something. They're gone. And the people there, quite understandably, wanted to build more branch stores, but you don't want to put more money into a business that's destined for failure. Now, we put $6 million of capital in that, and it was a dumb decision and everything, but that's $6 million. What would it be worth now, Charlie? They got 4/10 of a share.
A great many billions.
Oh, it's tens of billions.
Yeah.
Tens of billions. Now, if the department store had succeeded, we'd have a nice little business to send us a little check. But because it failed, we've made more than $25 billion in that. Didn't look like it at the time, though.
So when you realized it was a mistake, what did you do? How did you address it?
We asked Sandy, who was the best salesman among us, to go sell it. and we sold it, and we put the money into Berkshire.
We got about 95% of our money back.
Yeah, put the money into, and we'd borrowed $6 million in there, so now we had that. So we bought Berkshire stock, and we bought Blue Chip stock, and eventually put it all together. It looked like a plate of spaghetti at one time, which was not good. It was just complicated. And so we put them all together. And, you know, I've still got stock, and Charlie's still got stock that came out of Diversified Retailing, as do a number of my partners from the old days. The best thing that happened to us was that this place failed. It obviously was a failure.
Why? What did you learn?
Pardon me? Leave quickly.
Yeah, and use the capital someplace else. I mean,
one thing we've learned is if it's clear that something is a mistake, is to fix it quickly. It doesn't get better while you wait.
As the saying goes, to make an omelet, you got to break a few eggs. Around 1970, Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger started investing in a well-capitalized company called Blue Chip Stamps. It was a loyalty program, like your frequent flyer miles or the card you swipe at the local grocery store. A customer would buy something at a store and be given X number of stamps for Y dollars spent. You save up your stamps and buy something special, a lawnmower, something for the house.
So what was it about Blue Chip that you liked?
What attracted you to that business?
Well, it had a huge amount of cash and marketable securities on hand from the float. They sold the stamps for cash, and they didn't have to redeem them for toasters and radios and so forth until much later. And so it was a big float business, and we'd bought the equity very cheap. There were big antitrust attacks against blue chip stamps. And
it did not have an immaculate conception.
No, it didn't.
A group of very big oil companies and retailers got together because they were worried about Sperry and Hutchinson, which was the big stamp company coming out to California. So they defensively formed their own operation. And so actually the big company didn't like the littler company. and it was a complicated situation, but the fact it was complicated actually meant the stock was quite cheap. And Charlie and I and Rick Aaron all bought stock, not as a group, but we had ideas and we talked and we had a good time. We had a good time actually with the department store business. I mean, we learned things, we met nice people, and it's all been very, very interesting. But we did start with three failures.
How do you all manage to stay so calm through that? Most of the time people be putting up that amount of their net worth and they'd be very worried if they got into a situation that they realized was
I think we've both been used to betting with our own net worth since it was very small. It didn't change that much and the numbers got a little bigger. I used to play marbles at Saunders School and I would gamble for marbles. I mean, it wasn't like we had no experience dealing with wealth. I dealt with wealth when my wealth was marbles.
But part of that points to the lesson of leverage and not having bet the money that you don't have.
We've never liked leverage that much. And I've never borrowed a dollar. I wasn't sure I was going to pay back one way or another. We like getting some leverage through businesses like Blue Chip Stamps, where the people pay for the stamps in advance. Trading stamps, when you think about it, I mean, you know, airline rewards are the same thing. People love the idea of collecting little things that they then redeem for something they've kind of dreamt about for a while.
Credit cards are now reward systems.
But we had 100.
And those systems do create customer loyalties.
We had a 120-page catalog. I mean, people, they picked up their stamps at the grocery checkout counter and forgot their change. I mean, they were distributed through mortuaries and everything. I mean, it was a huge, huge craze.
And lasted a long time.
And we redeemed all our stamps. Now, a great many of the other stamp companies just disappeared. I mean, they had the money and they sold them. They just disappeared. You couldn't find a place to redeem the stamps. Charlie kept redeeming stamps. I said, well, you know, I mean, we got, as long as we have a stamp on there, he wanted to, I don't know how long we even had it. We had a little catalog.
Oh, we kept a redemption center for years after we stopped selling stamps.
So we had, I don't think any other stamp company really did that. But we had the use of the money for a time and we bought Berkshire shares with it.
Join us tomorrow on Squawk Pod, Buffett Buys and Buys More, our special podcast series on the backstory of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger's Wealth of Wisdom continues. Stay tuned for How to Be Honest with Your Friends.
He was working for clients and he thought he was smarter than the clients. And of course he was, but that's really not
it's not lovable.
You don't want to radiate that, no.
And one 97-year-old finds a pandemic silver lining.
Oh, I fall in love with Zoom.
That's all coming up this week on Squawk Pod. Special thanks to Becky Quick and CNBC Managing Editor Lacey O'Toole. And thanks to you. Like and follow Squawk Pod wherever you listen to podcasts. And we'll meet you back here tomorrow.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.